It's May 13th, 2017, New Vrindavan, and we're looking at meditating on Krishna throughout our day, throughout our life. And this is particularly, we're going to be looking at our time other than in our sadhana. So this morning we looked at sadhana, this is other than sadhana. And this is looking at the aspects of yoga, of dhana, meditation, and samadhi. Okay, so there was a handout. I hope all of you got the handout. I think extra copies are on the chair. And if you don't have a pen or pencil, you can borrow one from up here. Okay, so this little experiment we're doing is not going to be quite so indicative of your life, because I assume that most of you are not generally at a festival. But what can we do? So I want you to do something a little unusual. I'd like you to start from now and think backwards in about half an hour increments from now to when you woke up this morning, and what were you thinking about? So what were you generally thinking about? Try to capture the main thoughts in half an hour increments going back from now until you woke up. And just write them down. Not details, just like little notes about what you were thinking about. You understand what I'm saying? As far as what you can remember. You may be able to remember more what you were doing, but that might tie more into what you were thinking about. No, start now and go backwards. So from, 4 to 3:30, 3:30 to 3, 3 to 2:30, 2:30 to 2, like that. Again, it's not going to be that typical because it's not going to be your typical day. But still, we have to work with what we have. And I'm not going to ask you to try to do that from 3 days ago. Okay, even if we didn't finish all the way. How many of you at some point during the day thought either about food or money or both? How many of you at some point during the day thought about your relationships in this world? How many of you thought about some choices you need to make in life? How many of you thought about some suffering either you're going through or somebody else is going through? Okay. How many of you thought about Krishna, his associates, and pure devotees? Of course, being at a festival helps with that. I said this might not be typical. So sometimes we may feel that our mind is like this. So what we're going to try to do in this seminar is we're going to try to get our vision to where we see Krishna everywhere. So that no matter what we're thinking about, no matter what's going on in our life, that we see everything in relationship to Krishna. That we are not just seeing about the things in this world. Where do I get something to eat? How will I get some money? How is this relationship? What's going on with my problems? What's going on with other people's problems? What about this? What about this? But we're going to be able to see everywhere Krishna. So it's very nice in Bhagavad Gita 18.9, Prabhupada in the purport says, a man working in Krishna consciousness in a factory does not associate himself with the work of the factory, nor with the workers of the factory, he simply works for Krishna. And when he gives up the result for Krishna, he is acting transcendentally. So we wouldn't normally think about working in a factory as being conducive for meditating on Krishna. The Prabhupada is giving this example of working in a factory. I mean, I know that there are some devotees who think that if we don't, live out in the country and milk the cows, we can't think of Krishna. But Prabhupada's here saying, work in a factory. Right? And then in Bhagavad Gita 12.2, one of my favorite purports, Prabhupada says, sometimes he chants, sometimes he hears or reads books about Krishna, or sometimes he cooks prasadam, or goes to the marketplace to purchase something for Krishna, or sometimes he washes the temple or the dishes. Whatever he does not let a single moment pass without devoting his activities to Krishna. Such action is in full samadhi. So when we think of samadhi, we may normally think of like Shamakarishi. Remember when Maharaj Burkitt came to Shamakarishi and he was in samadhi? Did Shamakarishi hear Maharaj Burkitt?
No.
No, because before you go in samadhi, you're in prachadara. Prachadara is where you withdraw the senses from their objects. But remember, we've talked about prachadara as withdrawing from our material identity, not identifying in this world. And then you go into dhanana, where you're holding your actual identity, and then dhyana, where you're flowing in meditation and samadhi. And sama means what again? Equilibrium and deep intelligence or meditation. So being fixed in seeing things properly. So I want to look at the different kinds of yoga and how each of these kinds of yoga, how do they aim to get you to samadhi, and what does samadhi mean in each of these different kinds of yoga. You can actually categorize all the religions of the world into one or more of these different categories. Now, sometimes they're not really religions at all, they're just karmakanda. So there are some religions that are not even karma yoga, they're just karmakanda. But anything that's actually a religion is going to be one or more of these kinds of yoga. Okay, so in Gyan Yoga, what you're trying to do is attain samadhi through philosophically understanding the nature of the world. Through Dhyan Yoga, you're trying to gain samadhi by mechanically manipulating the body and the mind. In Karma Yoga, you're trying to gain samadhi by giving up the fruits of your action. And in Bhakti Yoga, you're trying to gain samadhi through attachment. Let's take a look here at this chart. All right, and what do each of them mean by samadhi, and how do they attain it? So, put bhakti yoga at the top. Bhakti yoga, exception of bhakti. So, in bhakti yoga, what do we mean by samadhi? What?
Always thinking of Krishna.
Always thinking of Krishna. Can anyone else tell me what you mean by samadhi and bhakti yoga? Yes?
All of the senses are engaged.
All the senses engaged in Krishna's service. Very nice. What else? Yes?
Keeping Krishna the center
of all activities. What else? Yes?
Acting with the intention of pleasing Krishna.
Acting with the intention of pleasing Krishna. Good. What else? Yes?
When one realizes that Krishna and the holy name are non-different.
Good. When one realizes Krishna and the holy name are non-different. What else?
Being always in thought of Krishna even during like regular activities.
Always in thought of Krishna even in regular activities. What else? Yes?
Seeing everything that's connected.
Seeing everything is connected with Krishna. Excellent. What else? Okay, very nice. Thinking 24 hours a day how to spread the Krishna consciousness movement. What else? Subjectively, how would you feel? Yes?
Deep feeling of gratitude towards Guru and Krishna.
Okay, deep gratitude towards Guru and Krishna. What else? How else would you
satisfied.
Feel?
Huh? Satisfied, fulfilled.
Satisfied and fulfilled. Excellent.
Of
belonging, okay, excellent.
Compassion.
Compassion, you'd have really deep compassion, yes.
Happy for no reason.
Happy for no reason. Okay. I think there's a reason. In other words, you're saying is you're going to be happy even when there aren't external material reasons.
Yeah.
That's what you mean. There are internal spiritual reasons.
Yeah.
But you're allowed to be happy even if there's no internal spiritual reasons to be happy. Okay. What else would be one's emotional experience?
Humility.
Huh? Humility, yes. Okay.
Peacefulness.
Huh?
Peacefulness.
Yes.
In love with Krishna.
In love with Krishna, you feel deep love, yes. Which might not always make you peaceful, but love does that to people. What else?
Enthusiasm.
Good, what else?
Freedom from all anathas.
Freedom from all anathas, just have a sense of freedom. Good, what else? Yes?
See Krishna in everything.
You see Krishna in everything, yes. What about other living beings?
Everyone is a part of Krishna.
See, everyone is a part of Krishna. We talked about compassion for other living beings. Yes?
See their spiritual identity rather than their body.
Okay, see spiritual identity rather than the body. Anything else? Yes?
Freedom from the modes.
Freedom from the modes, yes. Now, of course, we mentioned yesterday the modes are still acting in the body and the mind. But you don't what? You don't identify with them. You're just the observer. Well, actually, you're already an observer, but you realize that you're simply an observer. Okay? And so how does someone in Bhakti Yoga attain samadhi? What's the process for attaining samadhi in Bhakti Yoga?
Devotional service.
Devotional service.
Always thinking of Krishna.
Okay, well, that's the end, isn't it? So the end and the means are the same? Interesting. So the way we always think of Krishna is to always think of Krishna. Okay.
Chanting the holy name purely.
Chanting purely, okay.
Going to the temple.
Going to the temple, seeing the deity in the temple or having the deity come, yes?
Giving up material attachment,
okay.
Service to the Lord.
Doing service. Now, it's interesting, there's a lot of research in psychology that shows if you want to make your enemy your friend, don't serve them, but get them to serve you. Did you know that? See, often we think, if I do something for somebody, then they'll feel grateful or obliged. I was staying at somebody's house a while ago, and they had gone out somewhere, and the wife had left a bag of clothing at some, you know, it was like a public park, but it was another city. And she said, "Oh, I don't want to drive all the way back there." And I said, "Well, I know people there. Maybe some of them will be coming here, and I can ask them to stop and look for it." And she said, No. Then I'll owe them a favor." I said, "No, I'll ask them. I'll owe them a favor anyway. Maybe to get the bag." But this idea that if someone does something for me, I'm obligated. So I may think, well, if I do something for you, you'll feel obligated, and then you'll like me. Of course, we tend to not like people to whom we're obligated. Not like people to whom we're obligated. Isn't that interesting? You know, years ago, I noticed this trend in the Gurukula that the parents who caused me the most trouble were always in the group of families for whom I did extra favors. You know, if I make some adjustment in the policies or went out of my way for them somehow. Now, it's not that everyone I went out of my way for was a troublemaker, but all the troublemakers were people I'd gone out of my way for. And I thought, well, that's really peculiar. And in thinking about it, I thought, we don't really like it when we owe somebody something. Especially if we can't figure out how to pay them back. We actually feel uncomfortable. Right? If I owed you $5,000 and I had no idea how I was going to pay you, I would want to avoid seeing you. Just by the way, that phenomena happens with us with Krishna if we become lax in our Krishna consciousness, if we make some mistakes in our Krishna consciousness, it tends to push us further away. We don't want to see Krishna, we don't want to see the devotees. It makes it hard for us to get back up again. Just yesterday, one of the devotees was telling me how a mutual friend of ours had made a serious moral mistake, and after that hadn't talked to him for a year. Because he just felt, you know, I don't want to see somebody. I don't want to see somebody who's going to feel that I have something to make up. So anyway, that's not how we get people to like us. It's not by doing things for us. Otherwise, Krishna's doing everything for all of us. We all love him. But the way you get somebody to love you is to get them to serve you. Now, the way the psychologists explain it is, somehow we figure, if I'm serving this person, I must like them. Otherwise, why would I be doing anything for them? somehow it switches our thinking about them. That's their theory about why it works. But I'm not sure if that's a correct theory, neither are they. But the principle seems to be that if we do things for people, it gets us to like them. What's kind of the key word in bhakti? If we were thinking of one word in bhakti as to how we develop samadhi, what would it be?
Devotion.
Love, yes. And that implies attachment. That implies attachment. Now, material attachment means what exactly? Materially, I'm attached to people, things, places, activities that do what? Gratify my senses or my ego. Could be the mind, it might not be the gross senses. So what we tend to look for as a conditioned soul is I want things that taste good, smell good, feel good, sound good, look good, and I want people to tell me how great I am. That's basically what I'm looking for. I'm looking for people to say, you're wonderful, you're fantastic, you don't make any mistakes, you know, etc., etc., etc. So anything, anyone, or an activity even that makes me feel that way about myself, I accomplish something, say, yes, I did that, I am great. Even if nobody else tells me, you understand? So basically, we become attached to places, people, things, activities that do something for our senses and our ego. So what are we actually attached to?
Our body.
Our body and mind. Why are we attached to our body and mind? Because we identify with them, we think that they're ourselves. Okay, and we think that if they're not nourished, we would cease to exist. And Maharaj Brigid says that the main reason we have ultimately attachment for Krishna is he is the self of the self. He's the super soul. He's the soul of the soul. He's the soul of the universe. And Prahlad Maharaj says just like we're attached to ourselves, we should be attached to Krishna. But attachment to Krishna is on a little bit different level. Attachment to Krishna is really being attached to the self of the self. As Prabhupada would often say, our real self-interest. And it's not exactly what Krishna can do for me. Our attachment to Krishna is more what can I do for Krishna. Because we understand that as he's the self of the self, that there's not really a difference on one level of pleasing Krishna and pleasing myself. I'm the part of which he is the whole. We have a little bit of a concept like that materially, that if I serve my family, if I serve my society, I serve my institution, I serve my country, I serve my business, that is what's good for me. That's my real self-interest, to sacrifice my self-interest for the good of the whole. We have a little sense like that. Of course, that doesn't really work materially. It's not really operative. But our attachment to Krishna is not like what can I get from him, because I'm part of him, and it's just automatic. I mean, one thing you could compare it to would be, if you're with an organization or a company or whatever that has a mission that really inspires you, and that organization or that company or that group, they just take care of you. They give you whatever you need. And so you're not working for them because you get what you need, because you're getting what you need automatically. I'm not sure if that's clear. I mean, I was working for a project some years ago in ISKCON where I was just given everything that I needed. I was given nice prasadam and a nice place to stay, and all my material needs were taken care of. And I was very inspired by the project we were working on. And so I didn't think about my own needs. Does that make sense to anybody? I just didn't think about it. Kind of like the way a little child, it just feels I'm being taken care of. And they can just focus on their schoolwork, and they're not worried about how am I going to eat. Or, you know, the old traditional idea of the wife where the husband's just maintaining her and she doesn't have to worry about money and things like that. I don't know if that exists anymore, that kind of concept. So I could think completely and wholly about the project I was working on. I never had to think about what will I eat, where will I sleep, what will I wear. I could focus totally and give everything to the project, not because it was doing something for me exactly, but because I just felt so satisfied working for the project. So it's something like that, because Krishna is the self of the self. He's the soul of the soul. that when we become attached to Him, we forget about ourselves and we just start thinking about pleasing Him. Now also we have a little idea of this in the love of this world. A little idea. You know, it doesn't tend to last. But like in romantic love, people feel that way, at least at first. You know, again, it may not last, but at least you see this in the beginning of romantic sexual love. That people just think, you know, I just want to make the other one happy. I just want to make him happy. I just want to make her happy. And it's the same with when you're a parent. Again, it doesn't tend to last, but at least when they're very small, there tends to be this whole focus on, you know, I just want to make that person happy. I just want to make that person happy. And so we have a little bit of an idea like this, that our happiness is in the happiness of the other. Not because it's doing something for us, but just the happiness of the other. So that is how we get into the samadhi in bhakti. And materially, again, if you think about these material examples, these are all cases where we become absorbed. That project I was working on, I became completely absorbed in it. I didn't think about anything else. And when you love someone in this world, again, at least temporarily, you become absorbed in that person. Yes? It doesn't have to be a person. It can be a mission, it can be an organization, it can be an animal. Sometimes it can even be an object. You could become totally absorbed in your phone or something like that. Right? So our process in bhakti is the process of attachment. Maya Shaktam and Aparta. That we become attached to Krishna, not to get something from Him, but we become attached to the concept of making Him happy. That when we make Krishna happy, we automatically feel so satisfied that we forget about our own satisfaction. We don't forget about our own satisfaction because we're repressing or suppressing. We forget about our own satisfaction because it's so automatically included that it just recedes from our awareness. So that is our process in bhakti, is attachment. By the way, how do we become attached? What does Krishna say in the Bhagavad Gita 2:62? By thinking about things, right? As soon as I really think about something, I become attached to it. I contemplate and then I become attached, and my attachment eventually turns into lust. It becomes, what does lust mean? Lust means I want something so badly that I don't care what the consequences are. Right? And we think of this particularly with sexual lust. If you think about someone, say, like Bill Clinton, who, you know, you're the president of the United States and you're willing to throw that away over your lust for some intern. You understand? That means you're not thinking about the consequences. You just say, I don't care what the consequences are. I want this thing so badly, I don't care what the consequences are. So ultimately, one should have that intensity of attachment for Krishna. That I just want Krishna so much. You know, any of us here who are not fully surrendered to Krishna, the reason is our attachment hasn't gotten to that level. That we're saying, you know, I find myself, I'll say, oh Krishna, please give me pure devotion at any cost, as long as it's not this cost, this cost, this cost, or this cost. Any cost, except not those. You know, so this is, that's a lack of attachment. Everybody follow this? Yes? You know, and it's ironic that we will feel so attached to a material thing. Again, using the example of Bill Clinton, I mean, gosh, you know? You look at it and you say, that's really dumb. You know, logically, what is he getting? Like he's never gotten that before from anybody else. You know, what is he getting and what is he throwing away? And you look at it and you say, really? But when your attachment is that strong, or you can think of people who threw away everything, you know, for a bribe. Right? And it just, history is full of this. People, they throw away their money, their reputation, their position, their family, everything. For something, you look at it and you think, for that. But when your attachment is really, really strong, then you just don't, whatever it is. So that is the price. Right? Rupa Goswami says this greediness. I have to have it. 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 I have to have Krishna prema. By the way, this is a little tangent. Don't imitate that. Okay? I did that twice in Krishna consciousness. I went to Krishna and I said insincerely, I want Krishna consciousness at any cost. And he said, really? Let's try shaking this thing. And I went, no! And a few years later, I did it again. And I said, I'm going to wait. Now I just say, please bring me to the point where I can sincerely say that instead of faking it. Krishna doesn't like people who are inauthentic. People acting inauthentically. He's like, please cool it. But anyway, that's the process. Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita 12.9, the reason we're doing sadhana bhakti is to develop what? Icha. To develop desire. To love. Desire for Krishna is so strong that we don't care what the price is. And of course, the price is really, what is really the price? What are we really giving up to get Krishna prema? Get love of Krishna? What are we really giving up?
Our ego.
Our ego, which is causing us all of our
suffering.
All right. Yes. People often ask me, what should I call you? I say, I'm no idiot. The price for unlimited bliss and peace and ecstasy is giving up what's causing you all your suffering. I don't think so. Anyway, all right. Okay, in karma yoga, what does samadhi mean? That's the process. What does it mean to attain samadhi in karma yoga? He said giving up the fruits, but that's the process, not the definition.
Not attached to what you are doing.
That's the process. They said not attached to what you are doing. How are they going to define samadhi? Yes? Okay, liberation from the cycle of birth and death. What else? How else would people in karma yoga define samadhi?
Being equal and happiness and distress.
Excellent. Equal in happiness and distress, having equilibrium towards the world, being in a state of equilibrium.
Purifying your...
Well, that's again your fifth process. You don't know about the other yogas. Well, why is it good to look at the other yogas? Yeah.
Well, maybe we're like, as you're talking, I'm thinking, well, sometimes I'm in bhakti, but sometimes I'm in karma. I'm actually doing probably all four, because I do the postures as well. So I think that we're always in one of the four.
Well, it's interesting because bhakti does include elements of the other three yogas. Rupa Goswami suggests that although we may use the other three in bhakti, that we not cover bhakti by the other three. They don't have to be absent in order for us to be doing bhakti. And you can do mixed bhakti. Mixed bhakti will eventually also bring you to perfection. However, Rupa Goswami is advising us better to just do pure bhakti. It's a lot more fun and it's more efficient. But pure bhakti does include aspects of karma yoga, jnana yoga, and dhyana. It certainly does include those, but they should not cover bhakti. So it is important for us to understand these so that they don't cover our bhakti. What does it mean by covering our bhakti? It means if we think bhakti is dependent on them, if I think bhakti is dependent on the processes of karma yoga, jnana yoga, or dhyana yoga, or if I think I have to do them first. We were talking last time about chanting, and people who think, well, I can't think about Krishna when I'm chanting until I'm pure. If that's what they're thinking to become pure by something other than bhakti. They're thinking they're going to become pure, and then what else is there? The only other things are karma yoga, jnana yoga, and dhyana yoga. And then they're thinking, I'm going to become pure by being a good person for Krishna, or I'm going to become pure by philosophical detachment in Krishna service, or I'm going to become pure by less often. By mechanical means. So that's when we're covering. When I think bhakti is somehow dependent, that those become dominant over bhakti, But we meditate, we study philosophy, and we do. We offer the results of our actions to Krishna. So we certainly have those other elements. It's also useful because we're supposed to be preachers in some capacity. And as I said, all of the bona fide religions and spiritual processes in the world are in one of these four, or a combination of them. So it helps us as preachers, but also it helps us to, if we want to do pure bhakti, which is what Krishna advises and Rupa Goswami advises, then it's good to understand what the other ones entail. So what is the process for attaining samadhi and karma yoga?
What I've been saying, right?
What you've been saying, yeah, why don't you say that?
Working, you know, you're working to give up, or you're working without attachment to the fruits.
Working without attachment to the fruits. You basically do some work, and then you give away the fruits. And you're supposed to give away the fruits for the purpose of attaining liberation. So you're doing your work for the purpose of liberation rather than for the purpose of enjoying this world in heaven. Because that's the fruits of work, is I'm going to be happy in this life, and I'm going to go to heaven in the next life. So you give that up, and Krishna says, karma pala tyaga, if you give up the fruits of your work, you attain, anybody know? 12th chapter? If you give up the fruits of your work, you attain
peace,
which is also very much their idea of samadhi. Samadhi is this equilibrium, peace. Generally, they're aiming at the Brahman realization, merging into the Brahman. Occasionally, paramatma, but usually Brahman. So if you think about that, if I work, and every time I work, I take the fruits and I give them away, after a while, you become very detached, wouldn't you? Yes? Okay. All right, what about Gyan Yoga? What is their, generally their idea of samadhi? Huh? Sometimes paramatma. Generally, that's Gyan Yoga. Sometimes what? She said focusing on the Lord in the heart, paramatma in the heart. And I said that's generally Gyan
Yoga.
We are not the body, yes?
Merging
with the Supreme. So generally, the goal, the samadhi of karma yoga and gyan yoga is generally the same. To merge with the Supreme. But gyan yoga particularly is usually aimed at Brahman realization. I am one with God. I'm one with God. And then we have there's a Buddhist form where I just become nothing. The Buddhists usually perform either Gyan Yoga or Dhyan Yoga. But they're aiming not for Brahman, they're aiming for nothingness. They're saying, you know, realize you're the observer and then realize there's no observer. Yes. So anyway, their idea is also this equilibrium, that I become detached from happiness and distress. What else does Krishna mention? Happiness, distress, what else? Fame and infamy, what else?
Honor
and dishonor.
Heat
and cold. Happiness, distress, friends and enemies. Auspicious, inauspicious. So in karma yoga and gyan yoga, that's basically the kind of samadhi. And does that give you also a kind of happiness? Yes, definitely. So looking for peace, equilibrium, happiness, and a sense of oneness. And in gyan yoga, what's their process? Philosophical speculation, if they're really in Gyan Yoga, this philosophical speculation is based on the scriptures. So they're studying the scriptures and also studying the world. So you're studying the world, everybody dies, everything we do here is useless, nobody even cares. Right? All attempts to be happy just result in suffering. We talk about this stuff too, yes? It's not that we don't talk about it. That's why I said this is included in bhakti. And if you meditate on those things, do you become detached? Yeah, you do. Maybe not long term. But if you can imagine if you did that constantly, all the time, you would become very detached. Also, people practicing Gyan Yoga generally have a very heavy regimen of renunciation of material things. So in karma yoga, you can use material things, but you're offering food. In gyan yoga, you're generally kind of separated from material things. All right, what about dhyan yoga? What's their idea of samadhi? Yes?
Merging, or actually connecting with the super soul in the heart.
Connecting with the super soul in the heart.
Mystic powers.
Well, that's really not Dhyan yoga. That would really just be Dhyan. Just like karma, your idea is to become rich and famous and powerful. You understand? And in Dhyan, your goal is just to be insufferable. Which is, if you don't have the yoga bit. You know, so in karma, your goal would to be a perfect Rajaguru person, a big king, a big powerful king, rich person, full of Aishwarya. If you're just in Gyan, without Gyan yoga, then your goal would be to be in Satvagun, to be a big philosopher, a big poet, and to have that happiness. And if your goal is just Gyan, then you're looking for mystic powers. That you're looking for mastery over the body and mind. It's funny, when I was hearing Prabhupada saying in a lecture that the yogis take their happiness from mastery over the body and the mind, and then I realized that a lot of the happiness I got from like doing the full nirjal fast was that. You know, wow, I didn't eat any food, any water, I didn't get any sleep. I have mastered my senses. Yes. And I heard that in a lecture, and I thought, oh my God. I thought it was spiritual, it was all material, it was so disappointing. And so the Dhyan yogi is different from just the Dhyan person. So the Dhyan yogi wants to realize the super soul, so that there is some degree of personal relationship, but they are looking for this all-knowingness concept of the universe, which is, it's a little higher than the Brahman realization. So what's their process? What is that?
It's putting your body mechanically into samadhi. You know?
Yes. So there's certain ways of sitting or standing that tend to put you in a trance. And there's certain, just like, you know, we all learned when we were babies that if we lie down in a dark room, we'll fall asleep. Right? And we learned, most of us didn't learn immediately. It took us a little while, most of us, to learn how to fall asleep. Some people never really learn, and they have a problem with insomnia their whole life. But we generally learn when we're young, how can I, what, I put my body in a particular position, right? Yes? And then I breathe in a certain way, and then I go into sleep. So similarly, there's certain postures you can put your body in, and certain breathing patterns you can put your body in, that'll put you, instead of into sleep, it'll put you into a trance. It happens mechanically. The human body is designed. I don't think the animal bodies are designed for that, although perhaps they are. There's some people who say they can hypnotize animals and put them into trance. But the human body is designed, if you operate it in a particular way, to go into a state of trance, which is different from wakefulness, dreaming, and deep sleep. It's a different state of consciousness. And then once they're in that state of trance, then they work at controlling the mind. So they're working with how the mind's also a machine. Yes? So they're working with a machine. And they're trying to get the machine in a certain state so that it links with the super soul. And Krishna talks about this. As soon as the mind is steady, you tend to automatically achieve the super soul. Okay, so if we're going to categorize this, we have to say, the key word for bhakti is what? Process. The key word is?
Devotion.
Attachment. The key word for karma yoga is? Well, not just word. Renouncing. It's renouncing. And the key word for gyan would be? Philosophy. Philosophizing. Yes. Or contemplating, analyzing. And the key word for dhyan would be? Mechanics. Okay, so I really want to make the point about this, because this seminar is about being in samadhi all the time. That's what this particular seminar is about. Being in a state of samadhi all the time. Yes, you have a question?
What is the destination of someone who has successfully
There is a planet in the universe where Kshira Daksha Vishnu lives. He is the super soul. So wherever you go, Krishna says, wherever you worship, that's where you go. So one could assume that one goes to his planet. Of course, that's created and destroyed, so it's not a permanent position because the super soul only exists within the material world. We learn that the Brahman effulgence is also not generally a permanent position. They appear to be liberation, unless somebody can. Is that right?
Well, I don't know if I'd say that about Swayed if we find here that although it's in the material world,
it may exist after the dissolution. So maybe it's a kind of like Kunta Planet, but at a lower level of understanding?
Something like that.
Is destroyed. So it's a what?
Is it only in my kingdom, like there's only Vrindavan? Like there's earthly Vrindavan, is it like earthly Vaikuntha?
Yeah. Actually, Vrindavan's not Vaikuntha.
No, I'm asking about Shwedagreep. Is it analogous?
Yeah, it's like that. It's an eternally existing place. It's actually connected with some part of the spiritual world. It's said that it exists even when the material world is dissolved. At the very beginning of the material world, it exists in its totality there, even though the material world is displayed in this kind of stuff in the Maya, what is it? How, you know, Mayapur is there even when the
right, world. Right. The sections of Mayapur are still there, yes.
And as far as I understand, the same thing
with Swetadvi. Okay. So it's some level of Vaikuntha, but not, you're not fully with the Lord as Narayana.
In some way it's in both realms at the same time. It's kind of like when Vrindavan is in the same, you know, one sense of mundane, another sense of supreme form of the Lord, of consciousness, unlike any other places which are mostly just the material location.
Oh, I see, okay. And then you also have some of the mystic yogis get into worshipping Shiva also. And then there is an abode of Shiva that Sanatana Goswami describes as between the material and spiritual world. So the reason I wanted to go through this is I think a lot of us have an idea of samadhi that actually belongs to one of the other yogas. That was the main reason I wanted to bring this up. I think a lot of us have an idea of samadhi in terms of the Dhyan yoga specifically. That we think samadhi involves a mechanical pratyahara, mechanical removing of the senses from any awareness, where you're not seeing, hearing, smelling anything in the world. Yes? I mean, in that kind of a state, you really, it's something like how in deep sleep we're not aware of the world, but we're not really aware of anything. But in yoga, you're not aware of the world, but you're active within. You're aware of the world within. So we might think that samadhi is like that. But Prabhupada's saying one is in samadhi when you're washing the dishes. You're in samadhi when you're going to the market. So if you were in that kind of samadhi, it would be a little inconvenient and a little dangerous. You know? How are you going to drive your car in that kind of a samadhi? Or if we think of samadhi like Jnana Yoga and Karma Yoga, where I'm just simply equipoised. I'm simply detached. I'm not affected by heat and cold, happiness and distress, honor and dishonor, friends and enemies. I'm just peaceful and happy in all situations. You know, if we think of samadhi in the Karma Yoga, if we think of samadhi in the Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga mentality, then we tend to be looking at just what we're not. I'm not materially attached. And you see devotees in bhakti aiming for those kinds of samadhis or thinking that that's their goal or even that that's their process. You know, I'm going to attain samadhi through trance, and I think that's probably a minority. Or I'm going to attain samadhi through my detachment. Also, Adi Purusha Prabhu explained very nicely one time how he was really feeling that he wanted to develop all the good qualities, and then he realized, oh, this is a desire for liberation. Then I'm focusing on that separate from Krishna. But our process of attaining samadhi is devotion and attachment. That's our process. And for us, the detachment is a natural concomitant factor. Again, thinking materially speaking, you know, again, this may not last, but generally, at least at some time, when you have romantic attachment, you tend to forget about everybody else. Again, and that may not persist. So maybe a few months later, you start looking at other people again. But at least there's some time when you're like, that's the only woman in the world, that's the only man in the world, or just nobody else exists. You understand what I'm talking about? You just, you know, that's it. So that's what the kind of samadhi that we're looking for, where we become so attached to Krishna that, first of all, we're willing to give up everything for him out of love. And second of all, that we're not attached to anything else because he is so completely satisfied. Right? Materially, these things don't last because the object of our attachment is not completely satisfied. We become very attached to someone or something or whatever, and we're giving everything, and then after a while we're like, oh, and it doesn't last. Alright, so if the idea is attachment, so we have in the Krishna book, right, where Krishna was in Kaliya, when Krishna was in the coils of Kaliya, it says that out of their great affection for Krishna and being unaware of the extent of his potencies, the residents of Vrindavan became overwhelmed with grief and anxiety because they had nothing dearer than Krishna, and because they had dedicated their everything, life, property, affection, mind, and activities to Krishna. So this is also where we tend to have attachment. We tend to have attachment wherever we've dedicated everything. Wherever we've invested everything. Yes, that's why when the stock market crashed, people were jumping out of the windows. Because they had invested everything in the stock market. Why do we get so upset whenever our false identity is threatened? Because that's where we've invested everything. There was a drama we used to have at the Sunday feast, and I must admit that in those days I could not understand it. I was like, what is this about? Actually, before I tell you about that drama, during the presidency of Ronald Reagan, there was one woman, I think she lived in Mississippi, African-American woman, never married, never had any kids, and her job was washing clothes, but by hand. She didn't use a washing machine. She took people's laundry, washed it by hand, dried it by hand, an old-fashioned iron, brought it back. Do you think she made much money?
No,
not hardly any. She had one old broken-down television set. I don't even know if she had a car. She had an old broken-down black-and-white TV. And every week, she put $40 in the bank. Her mother had taught her saving money, so $40 in the bank. Every week, for years and years and years. One time she made a withdrawal of, I think, like $10 or $15 to buy a gift for somebody. And at a certain point, the banker said to her, you know, you have a lot of money. Maybe you should have an account that gives you more interest. And then she made some adjustment. And when she was ready to retire, she had something like $1 million in the bank. And so she started a college fund for poor African-American students. And it came to the notice of President Reagan at the time, and she got all kinds of awards. And then, of course, a lot of other people contributed to the fund and so forth and so on. So the drama that they used to show was called The Wrong Bank Account. And again, I just remember as a person new to Krishna consciousness, they never told you what it meant. They just simply did the play. And I was always thinking, huh? So it just... Have this guy, you know, who goes to work every Friday, he goes to put his paycheck in the bank. Thank you, sir, you know, and he's working. Then on Friday he goes to put his money in the bank, you know, doing that every week. And then it's time for him to retire, and unlike that lady who had $1 million, the guy goes to retire and he has nothing. And it turns out he was putting the money in the wrong bank account. Yeah, you can put money in other people's bank accounts, you know that, right? You have their account number, you can make a deposit in anybody's account. Yes? In fact, one way that people try to steal your account information is they'll make deposits of like 32 cents and 25 cents. And so then they'll keep making these small deposits, and then they'll establish with the bank that maybe they have a relationship with that account, and then they'll say, oh, I lost my this and that information. So what does it mean we're making a deposit in the wrong bank account? It means we're putting our energy our attachment, our affection into something that's not us. Which is what, again? It's our identity, our ego. And what's our identity? I am... No, the one, the wrong one. I am...
The body.
I am the body. I am this person's son, I am this person's daughter, I am this person's husband, this person's wife, mother, father. I'm a banker, I'm an actor, I'm a this, I'm a that. Remember, those of you who were in that seminar, we made that list of all of our identities. And we're investing in that identity. I'm doing a lot of things to be a good son. These are all these things, don't you? I'm doing all these things to be a good member of the Hare Krishna movement. So people will give me the maha with the curd in it. You know, I'm doing all these things to foster this identity. And then at the end, that identity becomes what? Finished. It's gone. Finished. It doesn't even have to be death. It doesn't have to be death. You know, sometimes in old age you forget who your mother and father and husband and daughter and you forget all those. I saw it myself in the old age home. So that can happen even during this life. It doesn't have to be death. We'll speak of death. That identity is finished. And if everything has been put into that identity, you end up with nothing. So instead, what we want to invest in is Krishna. And the main investment is emotional. Is this clear to everybody? Main investment is emotional. In fact, why are we advised to invest things like money and time? What does Jesus say? Wherever you put your treasure, there your heart is. Prabhupada told us on the Rish with buying the Detroit Temple. He said, wherever you put your money, that's where your heart will be. Isn't that true? Proprietorship turns sand to gold as soon as we spend. Because what does money represent for most of us, unless we were born into billions of dollars? What does money represent? It represents our work, it represents our time, it represents our energy, it represents what we consider to be ourselves. That's why we're being asked to give donations to Krishna, but Krishna doesn't need our money. That's why we're being asked to do all these things, because as we do all these things, our emotions tend to follow. Our attachment tends to follow. If I work really, you know, I really spend a lot of time investing in the deity, put a lot of effort, I spend money, then I'm going to be attached to the deity. So that's the point, is to get emotional attachment to Krishna, to Krishna's associates, to Krishna's Dham. Okay, so those of you who were here for last seminar, we went over what's called the well-formed plan. So I want each of us to think of, what can I do to increase my attachment for Krishna? What can I do to increase my attachment for Krishna? I'd like to think of something that you could do starting today. That you could do at least for the upcoming week. Today is Saturday. That you could do at least for the upcoming week. And if you could make a little plan. By the way, thank you all for coming off after lunch. I was thinking in the afternoon session we should have fireworks or something, you know, dancing rabbits, or I don't know, something to keep people awake. So, again, state it in the positive. State it in the positive. It shouldn't be, you know, I'm not going to spend so much time with my pet dog. It should be something positive you're going to do to increase your attachment to Krishna. You want to focus on emotional attachment, something that's under personal control. In other words, not going to be my local temple president is going to get together a book study club. Something that you can do. What specifically you'll do, how specifically you'll think, and how specifically you'll feel. Is it going to be under specific circumstances? Is it something you're going to do, you know, when you wake up, something before you go to bed, something before you eat? And will it be in harmony with the rest of your life? Now, it can be a very, very simple thing. I give this example a lot, that I do some seminars about Srila Prabhupada, and I often ask people to come up with a plan like this about attachment to Prabhupada. And one thing I came up with for myself one time, which I have kept up, was that whenever I say the pranam mantras to Srila Prabhupada, that I would say them, so whenever I say the pranam mantras, that's a specific circumstance, behavior is that I would say them very distinctly, Because it's easy to say to Mama, she knows herself, and say, Lord, Miss Mama, she knows herself. That's so embarrassing. Anyway, hi, that I would think about the meaning of the mantra, when I should think about what I'm saying. I offer my obeisances, Mala Vishnu Pradaya, you're at Vishnu, so to speak, Krishna Prasadaya Pujala, you're very dear to Krishna on this earth. I think about what it means, and feeling, I would actually try to feel some gratitude, and I would also try to feel some inspiration, a sense of inspiration, but I also want to counter voidism and impersonalism and so forth. So it was very specific circumstances, that is also obviously a positive, to meditate on Prabhupada's pranam mantras, something I can personally control, that was a specific circumstance, it was in harmony with my life, saying Prabhupada's pranam mantras was something I was already doing several times a day, taking an extra 10 seconds to say them, feel them, and think about them, the cost was practically nil. And I found that just that very simple thing really increased my attachment to Srila Prabhupada. So when we're talking about a plan like this, it doesn't have to be a complicated big plan. If there's one thing to remember from this seminar, is that you can get big changes in your life in small by doing small activities. That big changes don't necessarily have to come from big changes. You know, to get this much change in my life, I don't need to do this much of a difference. Often to get this much change, I only have to do this much of a difference. And I'm lazy. We were talking really about the lazy Baba, right? I'm very lazy. And so I'm always looking, seriously, so I'm always looking for how can I get the biggest bang for my buck? You know, what are the little things that I can do that are going to have big effects? And also, when I'm told about big things, I get very discouraged. I just look at that and go, oh man, I'm never going to do that. Great idea. You know? I've been to so many seminars and stuff. It's like, great idea, and I'm never going to do it. Forget it. So I'm always looking for things like that. So you can also think about things like that. You don't have to think great big. You know, I'm still going to start donating 80% of my money and just living under a tree. It doesn't have to be that kind of thing. So we take about 5 minutes, and please come up with a personal plan by which you're going to increase your attachment for Krishna. I'd like what you to do, if you're willing. If you're not willing, that's okay. But if you're willing, as after you write your plan, share it with the person next to you. So the reason we did this first is that the other things we're going to be working on are not going to be effective without emotional attachment. Because everything else that we're doing, without the emotional attachment and desire, will remain just philosophical. They'll remain just theoretical. So we really need to have this element of attachment. Okay. So here we're looking at some of the ways in which Krishna manifests in the world as the heat and fire, flower-bearing spring, the ability in man, a purifier as I am the wind, fire of digestion, right? Bodies of water, I am the ocean, I am the light of the sun. So Krishna gives all kinds of lists of how he can be understood in the world. So if you can look at your handout, we have some wonderful quotes here. This is just a sample of these things, and I'm going to read it out loud this time if you can just follow along. So the so-called sannyasi, Brahma Satyam Jagan Mitya, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Aruha Vijayana Param Padam Tato Padam Tida. These, Brahma Satyam Jagan Mitya, Jagat is not Mitya. To the Vaishnava, to the devotee, we cannot accept that this Jagat, this world, is false. No, how can it be false? Suppose you enter in a very beautiful garden, very nicely trees, so many nice flowers, building. Everything is, they are nice. The proprietor of the garden takes you to show you. And if you say, oh, it is all mitya, which means false, oh, it is all mitya, then how much depressed he becomes. Just see, I brought this friend to show the beauty of this garden, and he said it is mitya. Similarly, we don't want to depress Krishna. That is not our business. Krishna has created this nice world. Everything is very nice. The sun is rising just in exact time. It is setting in exact time. The moon is rising. The seasons are changing. And we are getting nice food, nice fruit, nice flowers. So we are not depressing agent. We don't discourage Krishna. Why? Krishna has created this nice world. How can I say it is mithya? It is the byproduct of Krishna's energy. So Krishna's energy cannot be false. It is eternal. Krishna is eternal. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, this material world, these are eight kinds of separated energy of me, Krishna. So Krishna's energy, Krishna's truth. So Krishna's energy is also truth, because from truth, false cannot come. If Krishna is truth, this energy is also truth. It is not false. Therefore, we do not accept this Mayavadi theory that the world is false, Jagat Mithya. We say that Brahman is Satya, and this world is also Satya. The difference is that a devotee relishes a particular type of mellow rasa in this material world. Amazing, isn't it? Never thought that, did you? But those who are not devotees, they do not feel any relish from this material world. They feel for some time, but when it becomes stale in their taste, they say it is false. Just like the same example, the jackal first of all tried to get the grapes, jumping, and when it was a failure, he said, "Oh, the grapes are sour, I don't require it." So except devotees, the non-devotees, the karmis, gyanis, yogis, they actually do not relish the sweetness of the creation of Krishna. So that's one quote, there's another one here. Narada Maharaj said that this world is Krishna, idamhi Vishnam Bhagavan Ivetara, but it appears like it is different from Bhagavan. Actually, there is for a Mahabhagavata, he has no such conception, material conception, because he sees everywhere Krishna. Stavara Jangama Deke Na Deke Tara Murti. He is seeing one tree, but he's forgetful of the tree. He is seeing energy of Krishna. As soon as he sees the energy of Krishna, he sees Krishna. Therefore, instead of seeing the tree, he sees Krishna. Because one after coming in reference to the context, as soon as he sees anything we call material, he sees this as the conversion of the energy, parinamavada, sarvedam akilam jagat, parasva brahmana shakti. Parasva brahmana, just like as soon as you see the sunshine, you see immediately sun, is it not? In the morning, as soon as you see within your window the sunshine, immediately you remember sun. And you are confident, sun is there. Without sun, how can there be sunshine? Similarly, whatever we see, if we immediately see Krishna with reference to that particular thing, because that particular thing is the manifestation of the energy of Krishna. So those who have understood Krishna along with his energies, he sees the energy, because energy is not different from the energetic, he sees immediately Krishna. Therefore, he does not see anything except Krishna. So therefore, for him, there is no material world. There is no material world. To a perfect devotee, there is no material world. Prabhupada said that how many times? Three times right there. Everything is spiritual. Sarvakalamidam Brahman. He sees everything Brahman. So we have to make our eyes to see Krishna. Tadparatena. As soon as we are in Krishna consciousness, our seeing, touching, smelling, everything becomes nirmala, purified. Then we can immediately see Krishna. These eyes, so long as it is not purified, we cannot see Krishna. As soon as it is purified, you see Krishna. As soon as it is purified, you see Krishna. Nothing but Krishna. Woo! What do you think? Does that sound like a nice kind of samadhi? All right. So Krishna says that he's the seed-giving father. He says, "I am the seed-giving father." All right? So how could we meditate in such a way that seeing fathers helps us to see Krishna? And as we're going on in the world in our normal consciousness, most of us, maybe some of us, but anyway, most of us, I assume, don't actually just see Krishna. I see there's a father, right? Like I'm seeing here's a mother. That's your child, right? Is that your child?
Yeah.
Okay. Is this your child? Okay. So I'm saying here's a mother. So I see you as a father. So how can I see a father? Instead of just seeing a father, I can understand there's Krishna. So this is my little meditation I'll read to you. Most religions describe, I'm reading from my computer, not from the paper. Most religions describe God as the Supreme Father of the universe. So it's no surprise that Krishna describes himself in this way. During a normal day, we have interaction with so many fathers. Perhaps we are ourselves a father. We may have dealings with our own father. Oops, went a little too far. With our own father, or the father of our children, or those who are fathers to other children. In addition to human fathers, we experience fathers in various species of mammals, fish, insects, and birds. Just like here, you may notice that the swans are about to become parents, and the father is very aggressive, if any of you take any time to watch the swans. So the father swan will not let that duck enter that pond. Have any of you noticed that? And that duck is determined to enter that pond. There are other ponds. I keep saying, look, there's another pond over there. Anyway, so we may see fathers of different, you know, he's like, keep away from my eggs and my lady. We may experience fathers in other species. We can meditate on how Krishna epitomizes the ideal epitome of fatherhood. He is the provider, maintainer, teacher, guide, protector, confidant, and well-wisher. As the perfect father, he loves all equally and never envies his children. Indeed, like any father, he aspires for each of his children to achieve greatness. He is happy to stand in the background and let his children take credit. This is my personal meditation on how I can remember Krishna when I see fathers. Right? You're a father also? Is that your child? Is that your child? Yes. So if you look, here's the father. Everybody look at the father. There's the father and child. And instead of just looking, oh, there's the father, you can see, oh, there's the father. Oh, Krishna says he's the father. But this, just like this father has affection for his child, Krishna has affection for me. Just like this father is guiding and maintaining, Krishna's guiding and maintaining me. Okay. So I have here a list. This is not a complete list, but this is a list from the Bhagavad Gita. This is from chapter 7, 9, and 15. I don't think I took anything from chapter 10. 7, 9, 10, and 15 of the Bhagavad Gita are specifically where Krishna talks about how he can be understood in the world. There are also descriptions in the Bhagavatam, particularly in the universal form. So if you look at your paper now, I've given two examples. So I've given an example from Gita 15:12 and an example from Gita 9:18. So one, Krishna says, I am the splendor of fire, and I've written a little meditation there about how when I see or interact with fire, I can remember Krishna. Then Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 9:18, I am the resting place. I wrote a little meditation there about how Krishna is the resting place. So I'd like you to take something from what Krishna says he is in this world. You can use any of the ones that are up here on the screen. If you have your own handy-dandy Bhagavad Gita with you, you can also look up something from chapter 10, because as I say, I don't believe I have anything up there from chapter 10. If you're more into chapter 10 than 7, 9, or 15. I'd like you to get in, if you're an introvert, again, you can do this on your own. That's fine if you really hate groups. Otherwise, I prefer if you work in groups. Preferably groups of three. You can also work in a group of four. And please pick one of the things that Krishna says he is and write your own meditation. So you have that here on the paper. Is that clear? Yes? Okay, I hope you found that helpful. I want to look now at Krishna's name. So, of course, Krishna has so many names. I'd like it if anybody could suggest a name of Krishna that they like and how something in the world would remind them of that name of Krishna. Yeah. Gopina. Okay, what in the world, what that you encounter in the world would remind you of that name?
My Guru Maharaj named my son Gopinath. So,
Gopal.
Easy to remember.
Okay. Any other name of Krishna? Yes.
Govinda.
Govinda. What in this world can remind you of that name?
He's my nephew.
Prashadam. Oh, come on, you guys. A little bit more creative than that. Yes. Yes. Laddu Gopal reminds you whenever you eat a laddu, right?
Yes. And the other is Makhan Shor.
Whenever you work with butter. Oh, very nice.
Parthasarathi.
And what in the world reminds you of that?
The cover of the Gita.
Huh? The cover of the Gita. The cover. Talking generally in the world. When you're out and about.
Driving.
Okay, when you're driving your car, you can think about Krishna's Parthasarathi. Yes, there we go. Yes.
Gopal.
Gopal, what reminds you of Gopal?
In the village, little children go herding with the cows.
Little children go herding the cows in the villages. Where do you live?
Madan
Mohan. What in the world reminds you of that?
When I look at the beauty of this creation, like, look at the world, like, when I go to mountains or like...
Oh, mountains, how Krishna is the attractor.
So, look at the beauty.
Okay, very nice.
Shyam
Sundar. Shyam Sundar, what reminds you of that?
Dark rain clouds.
Dark rain clouds, very nice.
Nattabar.
What reminds you of Nattabar? Whenever you see people dancing. Excellent, yes. Radha Vrindavan Chandra, what reminds you of that name?
Well, the moon, just the beauty of Vrindavan.
The beauty of Vrindavan, okay, or the moon. All right, and let's think about Krishna's form. Okay, so do each of us have a favorite form of Krishna? Maybe a favorite deity, a favorite painting, or a favorite particular form of Krishna? We're running out of time, so I don't have time to do this. What?
Bal Krishna.
Oh, very nice. So it's wonderful if we can make an effort to actually remember that particular form throughout the day. Okay, I want to move on to Krishna's qualities. So here I put different pastimes. Okay, this quality of Yasoda with Krishna. What quality of Krishna does this picture remind us of? Well, that's Yasoda's quality. What quality of Krishna?
Attractive,
mischievous, what else?
Innocent,
okay. What about Krishna with Draupadi? What quality does that remind us of?
Protection.
And Krishna in the womb with Mars Brigitte?
Chivalry,
okay. So we have here a list of Krishna's qualities. Looks like, yeah, we've got all 64. All right, so look on your paper. And you can do this by yourself or with a group. We'll just take 5 minutes for this. Pick any quality of Krishna from this list of 64. And how could you realize this quality in some story from your own life? You don't need to write it down, you can just discuss it. What experience have you had in your own life that demonstrated to you one of these qualities? So if you can just, maybe just in pairs, if each of you can just say to somebody else, what is there in your life where you became aware of this quality of Krishna? Do you understand that? Looking at this list of how many of Krishna's qualities I've experienced in my own life. You know, how he's the controller, how he just arranges things so perfectly, and you look back and say, wow, somebody was really controlling that. Ever fresh, you know, every time you pick up the books, you find something new in them. Like, where did that come from? Forgiving, you know, even though I'm always offending Krishna, he keeps me around. All right, we want to look at pastimes. So I just put out here some samples, but of course there's so many pastimes. Pastimes, different incarnations. We have Krishna here with the fruit vendor, milking the cows, Matsya Kurma, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So maybe you can work with a different person this time. And I'd like you to pick any pastime. And then what activities remind you of that pastime? I remember once when I was working at public school, there was some exhibition of gymnastic dance. The students did some like exhibition of gymnastic dance. And immediately I thought of Ras Lila. You know, so pick a pastime, and then what things in this world can remind you of that pastime? So please work with just one person, and how to be a different person than you worked with last time on the qualities. Right? So we can do that. Pick a different buddy than last time.
Last time I spoke this time I let him go.
No, you work with him, you can work with her.
Last time.
This one here? And this is Krishna milking the cows.
Can you say what exactly is?
I'd like you to think of a pastime, and then what kind of things in the world could remind you of that pastime? I mean, just like, say, Krishna stealing the garments of the gopis. You could think of that whenever you see a tree. Whenever you see clothes.